Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and senior market analyst here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. And on this episode, we're excited to have another special guest interview, this time with Tim Savage from NYU. Dr. Savage is a clinical assistant professor at NYU Shack Institute of Real Estate. He is the faculty director of the CREFC Center for Real Estate Finance and the faculty co-director of the NYU SPS Applied Analytics Lab. With almost 25 years of industry experience, Dr. Savage has a strong background in econometrics, machine learning, and data science, making him a leading authority in applying these tools to real estate finance and economics. Before joining NYU, Dr. Savage held prominent positions at international firms such as Charles River Associates and CBRE Advisors. His work has been instrumental in guiding institutional investors through the complexities of macroeconomic trends, fiscal policy, and technological disruption in real estate. In his role with the Commercial Real Estate Finance Council, Dr. Savage has further influenced industry standards and practices, contributing to the organization's mission of promoting liquidity, transparency, and efficiency in the commercial real estate finance markets. Dr. Savage's insights have frequently been cited in major publications like The Economist and The Wall Street Journal, and have shaped the strategic decisions of industry leaders. Dr. Savage, it is wonderful to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
And Omar, I'll kick it off to you to get us started.
It's really great to have you on. I think we met a number of years ago and have kept in touch, and I've learned a lot from you over these years, and really happy to have you sharing your insights and about yourself with our listeners. To kick it off, can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you went from commercial real estate investment research, and ultimately how you have ended up at NYU Shack?
Sure. I got my PhD in 1999 from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with a concentration in econometrics and, oddly, microeconomics, the study of small markets, and went into consulting, began teaching after doing a lot of consulting, began teaching as an adjunct at something called the NYU Center for Urban Science and Policy, or CUSP. And I walked into the classroom for the first time in a while, and I said to the students, what do you want to learn here? What do you want me to teach? So here's the syllabus, but the last two classes are up to you. Do you want to learn about Bayesian econometrics, or do you want to learn about nonlinear statistics? What do you find interesting? And they all voted Bayesian. And I said, well, good choice. And then I honestly just got a call from a recruiter, or a LinkedIn message from a recruiter, saying, hey, there's this thing in Boston called CBRE Econometric Advisors. It's the old Torta Wheaton Research Group. Is that something that you would be interested in leading? And I thought, that actually could be, as a New Yorker at the time, I thought that could be really interesting, right? You can't live in New York and not live and breathe real estate all the time. So I trained up to Boston, did an interview that included the truly great Bill Wheaton, who remains a friend till this day. Sadly, by that point, Ray Torto had retired, and sadly, we lost him this year. And they made me the job offer. And I said, okay, well, I'll try to figure this thing out. And I went up, and I quickly realized that the tech there wasn't very good. And as much as I love the folks at CBRE, it can be a little bureaucratic. So making requests to try to rebuild this organization fell on deaf ears. And then the opportunity to come to Shack arose, and I thought, okay, I've never taught full time. And so I signed up, and I was an unknown professor 5 years ago, and last year had over 230 students. So it's been a highly nonlinear path through real estate, but I've enjoyed it a great deal. And students still email me, and I just so enjoy the connectivity that I have with students that this nonlinear path has turned out to be very fun.
That's fantastic. I love the description of bringing in the nonlinearity. I think that's something you're probably familiar with in your research by itself. But I think that I can hear the excitement that you have really in shaping the next generation of real estate practitioners and researchers, whether it's through your real estate data analytics or your real estate finance courses. But I know that you're also involved with the NYU SPS Applied Analytics Lab. Can you speak about some of the work that you're doing at the lab?
Yep. Again, just as the CREFC Center is meant to bridge the gap between the way people look at finance mathematically and how it's actually applied in practice, the Applied Analytics Lab is trying to bridge the gap between what is done academically and what we can essentially do industrially. It's still very early on, but my hope is to essentially create this neutral place where real estate data can live safely, be accessed by students, and we don't have to worry about some of the big juggernauts out there. We're really trying to prepare the next generation for what I think probabilistically is very likely, which is the role that data and analytics play in commercial real estate, because we are an industry, it's a new version of Torta Wheaton, and that's what the Applied Analytics Lab really is.
That's fantastic. And so it's finding what's possible and the potential before it gets commercialized. Is that correct?
Yeah. The story is that Bill and Ray met on a corner somewhere in Boston, and they were both professors, and they said, hey, we have these great ideas. And the industry at that time, in roughly the early 1980s, was really primitive when it came to data. There wasn't historical data on rents and vacancies. And that's where Bill and Ray began, which was to build out a historic database of rents and vacancies. And then they would continue to expand that. And when they finally had enough data, they started forecasting, which was a natural evolution of the entire process. And that's really what we're trying to do with the Applied Analytics Lab, to recognize that the next generation of analytics in real estate will involve big data, will involve a lot of alternative data sources to help us to think about things like retail development or multifamily development, using really interesting data sources that historically the industry has largely ignored, partially because we didn't know about them. That's the goal. And I just want to continue to teach students how to use this stuff.
In addition to the lab and uncovering what the potential is for real estate and data and the incorporation of data into real estate, I know that you're also very much involved with CREFC's Center for Real Estate Finance. You mentioned that the objective is really connecting the industry of practitioners to the university and academia. How is that getting done? Can you speak a little bit more about that center?
Sure. NYU won a competitive bid from CREFC for $1.5 million, which is not a lot of money by NYU standards, but it's still real money, to launch a center to focus on these sorts of things. And I was asked by the associate dean at the Schack Institute at the time to take a hold of this and try to give it some form, give it some function. And I put on my CBRE hat at that time and said, okay, I can try to give it some form and function. And working with the great people at CREFC, in particular Lisa Pendergast, we have launched something that is really trying to meld what Lisa says in public, what practitioners say in public, and what we academics say mostly in the classroom. And we do some really great things. We have four scholarships a year that are very large, because the fund was deposited at one of the downturns, basically the COVID downturn. So the fund has a lot of money now, and we endow 4 generous scholarships, 2 at the graduate level, 2 at the undergraduate level. And I get the luxury of attending the various CREFC conferences where Omar and I often run into each other, where I can engage with practitioners. And sometimes I'm quiet. There are times I want to raise my hand and say, do you know what a supply curve is? Do you know what a demand curve is? But I largely, when the topic of monetary policy comes up with CREFC, I usually keep my mouth shut.
We might change that on this episode, but we'll at least try to pry. But I guess putting your market or your investment research hat back on for a moment, taking a kind of a 30,000 foot view, what are some of the forces and trends that you really see as being critical and to driving today's CRE market or characterizing today's CRE market?
I think that we really underestimated how work from home would evolve during COVID, which is odd because there's some great research from a Stanford professor by the name of Nicholas Bloom, who had pointed to technological evolution in work patterns and the ability for us to begin to eliminate commute times. And we saw this before COVID accelerated it. And work from home is a big challenge for the industry currently. It impacts certainly office space, which has bifurcated tremendously. It has impacted retail, and retail and industrial are very closely linked. And then it's affected multifamily because suddenly our apartments became our offices. And it's a technological trend, a disruption that I think the industry wanted to ignore and has finally accepted. And then I would just say, then the industry needs to finally accept that a 100 basis point 10-year U.S. Treasury is in the past. Just that is gone. And it has to begin to accept the implications that has for cap rates and valuation.
Going off of that last point, I remember that you pointed out on a number of presentations, very well done presentations, of looking at the long-term trend of interest rates. And I believe one of the points you were making is that if you do take this almost century or multi-century view, that they've had this pretty consistent downward trajectory. Do you still have that view, or has that view changed? And if so, how?
It's changed a little bit. There's certainly, if you look at centuries of interest rate data, the long-dated interest rates have come in considerably, in part because we've eliminated the risk premium and we don't go to war so much anymore, or we don't sail off the edge of the planet. So that risk premium has shrunk, but we're at this point now where we have to reflect on what an interest rate really is. When I teach it in finance, I say, oh, okay, an interest rate is the price of money, but I think more foundationally, it is the value of time. And when the 10-year U.S. Treasury is bumping in around 53 basis points, which was its nadir during COVID, that's essentially the market saying time has no value. And that, I think, is foundational to thinking about finance as it applies to real estate, because a 4 handle at the moment essentially says, given current economic conditions, inflation falling, still a robust job market, the value of time is higher. And that is what we've shrunk the risk premium, but now we're down to the basic idea of what an interest rate is, which is the value of time. And that's a really important way to think about this.
Do you think that we're going to return to the world of, I think I've heard somebody refer to it as the world of threes, right? Where it's 3% GDP growth, 3% inflation, and you have a three handle on treasuries. Do you think that world of threes is coming back?
Yeah, so I would change that a little bit and say 2.5% nominal growth. We will get back to the Fed's target of 2% inflation. And if you think interest rates, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury is going back to 2 to 3%, you don't know who Jay Powell is. And you haven't listened to what he said. You haven't listened to what any of the prominent Federal Reserve regional presidents have said, which is to say, we have to normalize interest rates. This period since the global financial crisis is over, and we have to recognize that. And Jay Powell, happily, is not an economist. He's a lawyer, but he understands that an interest rate is the value of time.
So if we're looking at, and I hate the term new normal, but if we're normalizing and going to something that historically looks a little bit more normal, but if you shorten the time window that you're observing since post-GFC to COVID, maybe that was the abnormal time, where would you say there's the most mispricing in commercial real estate? Whether that's a specific sector, maybe that's on like growth assumptions, maybe that's on overall values. But do you see any sort of mispricing or risk to commercial real estate that's currently present in the market?
And nothing that other people haven't talked about, right? We talked about the bifurcation in office space, right? And in large markets like New York, I don't want to localize this solely to New York, but in large markets like New York, we're oversupplied with Class B and Class C office space. Those values have to fall given technological change. And even within the A class, what we call the A class, we're seeing bifurcation. There are assets that are new and can command very high rents. And there are assets that are no more than 10 years old that are becoming obsolete more rapidly. So again, let me describe to you just briefly my walk into work. So take the ferry over the East River and I walk from 34th to 42nd. There's a lot of retail vacancy that seems to be falling. You walk by many Class B, Class C office space that cannot possibly be performing and would be a challenge to convert profitably. Right? And then I always love to walk by One Vanderbilt on 42nd because it is truly a trophy asset. I obviously love to look down at the Empire State Building, love to look at the Chrysler Building, but you see One Vanderbilt as this real trophy asset. And they are able to command very high rents because they're very tall and they have lots of amenities. So this bifurcation is a really important point. I make this point in class and I emphasize it by pointing to another area in real estate, which is the sort of evolutionary bleeding edge of real estate, which is retail. And if you look at the evolution of retail from a dry goods store in 1880 to the overdevelopment of malls 20 years ago to e-commerce today, retail is the bleeding edge because folks in retail always understood their only function was to get goods from producers to consumers. And office folks always thought, you sign a 10-year lease, you pay rent every month, and we'll talk to you in 9.5 years. And that was the office mentality pre-COVID. And they don't have that luxury anymore. Certainly not in B or C class.
I like that. And I like that comparison to retail, particularly because it's the retail being that point of transaction where the supply meets the demand. That makes a lot of sense to me. I've seen and heard multiple researchers make this comparison to retail, but they frame it in terms of the demise. But the point about how it works and why it fits together and why it is that bleeding edge, I think this is the first time I've heard this, and I like that explanation. That makes a lot of sense.
Especially e-commerce. I conducted some research to think about the role of e-commerce in retail. And I started from a faulty premise, which was to assume that every dollar that moved from physical in-store consumption to e-commerce would be one for one. And that was wrong. We basically helped to show that the evolution of e-commerce actually is somewhat complementary to in-store commerce. It's not a one-to-one substitute. And I found that fascinating because I don't shop very much, so it's a bit of a black box to me, but it is interesting to think about retail as the bleeding edge. This is not, however, I think the same way we can think about Class B or Class C office space. This really is a substitution. Technology has allowed us to change work behavior in a way that doesn't require us to go into the office. And I would not want to be a Class B or Class C office owner at the moment.
Would agree with that.
Hey, I think Omar and I talk about it all the time. The building that we're in, which is in that stretch that you mentioned in the 30s and the 40s, there might be three tenants out of the 11 floors, and we're one of them. It's pretty remarkable, but I can see, would not want to be in that space either. I've got a few questions. We're going to take a step back up to where we were at the beginning here. And you talk about keeping your mouth shut while you're at Cref C. We're going to try to pry a little out of you, though. So talking about your historical view on interest rates and monetary policy, what's your current outlook if you had to sum it up? And if you've already covered some of that, maybe do elections matter? Is that going to be the thing that kind of drives the needle this time?
So I am not a political prognosticator, but I can sort of reflect on sentiment at Cref C. Right? Cref C has a very prominent January conference in Miami. Lovely to fly down there, get some warmth. They also have an early June conference. This year, the mood among the people speaking dramatically changed between January and June. January, it was, we're going to have 6, 7, 8 rate cuts this year. Jay Powell won't let us down. And the mood in June was, maybe we'll get 2 rate cuts. And it's when people get out over their skis on monetary policy when I really keep my mouth shut. They were out over their skis in January trying to price in, essentially forcing the market to price in the idea of 6 to 8 25 bit reductions, to finally recognizing that's not going to happen. I probably shouldn't use the word capitulate, but they finally capitulate to recognizing that Jay Powell is not the guy they thought he was. As for the election, I don't know. Technically, the term is stochastic, right? It's essentially truly random. And I don't know. And I don't know whether that affects monetary policy or not.
Fair enough. And, you know, I attended both Cref C conferences as well. And I think you go to that January conference, it's Miami, the weather's nice, there's 3,000 people, there's parties. And now you fast forward to June, it's 90 degrees, you're in Times Square, there's half the crowd. I think there's a little bit of a human element to it, but I think you're right. There's been some capitulation. I definitely sense that from the vast majority of panels. And mind you, these are the same folks that were talking 6 months ago too. I think that they're finally just realizing what's happened. You mentioned that the market had possibly priced in a lot of rate cuts at the beginning of the year, but I guess I want to talk to some of those trends you're talking about. Do you see that the market has yet to price some things in? Are there some other kind of macro trends that maybe this could still be remote work, onshoring, nearshoring, perhaps like turmoil in the housing market, insurance? What are some things that you think the market hasn't priced in yet?
Definitely insurance and climate change. So this past spring, I had my students write a market analysis of the Miami office market. And I've had the same assignment in the finance class for several years, and students are finally recognizing that insurance, in terms of its expense or the lack of it, is a big impediment to some markets like Miami in a way that it is not quite to New York. And I think the importance of climate change is not being assessed properly in valuations, even in more frothy markets like Miami. Despite the fact that the stock is newer, it is Miami, so it's not cold in the winter, but it's boiling hot in the summer. Those are the sorts of trends that I think are becoming relevant to the industry. I just don't think the information along those lines is necessarily going to come from the brokerages. That was one constraint that I always faced at CBRE. It was we were a sell-side brokerage. And so the research had to have a little bit of a light pitch to it that it's always sunny. And I called the 2020 recession based solely on the yield curve in 2019. Just as I've now essentially said, and this is all published, that absent some absolutely stochastic or unforecastable shock, the U.S. economy continues to perform fairly well by historic measures, whether it's employment growth or even, frankly, inflation, which has come in a great deal in the last year and a half.
So you talk a little bit about the fact that I think a lot of people are trying to answer this insurance question and trying to address a lot of these climate change issues. I think you talk about CREFC. You can't stop step 10 feet without being approached by a new data model of some sort, somebody trying to pitch you something, and they're all advertising new data on the climate. But what's the biggest unanswered CRE question for you? What are you trying to better understand about the economy or CRE that you think some people aren't talking about?
Certainly the impact of climate change on insurance is a major one. I wish that prices would adjust. And this is, let me express it as a wish or a desire, right? The old difference between normative and positive economics. I wish prices would adjust more rapidly in real estate. We've had the market capitulate on interest rates. I think the commercial real estate market needs to begin to capitulate on values. And then we can begin to figure things out. And as boring as it is, we get back to local policy. Dull issues like zoning and redevelopment, and whether you could actually, even if you could profitably convert some of these old buildings we walk by every day, could you rezone the area around Bryant Park? Could you basically reconstruct 11 West 42nd as a residential space? And that, I think, is a real challenge. And at times, we have an absence of bulldozers and wrecking balls in New York, because we have a lot of excess space. And this is true, and it's not just New York. It's New York, it's Chicago, it's every major city where real estate is concentrated. We simply have an oversupply. And the question comes down, can we convert this profitably? Or should we just knock it down because the land value is greater than the structure that sits on the land?
Too much red tape, not enough bulldozers. I like that. That'll be the headline. But shifting attention to data science, analytics, innovation within commercial real estate investment research, how would you describe the current state of real estate analytics and data science?
It's sort of okay and getting better. I think that, again, we may have gotten a little bit out over our skis in trying to deploy large language models, some of these very advanced techniques, when simple analytics can suffice. This is, as I say, I just reflect on the evolution of Torta Wheaton, of CBRE Econometric Advisors when I think about this. And they started out with a very simple principle, which was to come up with a regularized set of data and to deploy, having done that, to deploy relatively simple forecasting models. And I think that is something the industry should reflect on, in particular because the industry is becoming a little more fragmented. Back in the day, what Bill and Ray said was ironclad in the industry, right? Rents are going to rise, cap rates are going to fall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The industry is now becoming more fragmented so that everybody, all these large private equity firms now have data science shops, which I applaud, but the folks they are bringing in my opinion, don't have the understanding of real estate to begin with, because the analytics have to be driven by domain knowledge. Otherwise, it's useless. You're just exhausting computer power. It's why I find this development, rapid development of data centers so fascinating. And I gave an interview, brief interview last week on the importance of power consumption with data centers. And for this reporter, I simply said, look, these algorithms need a lot of chips. Think about it like a Christmas tree. Old Christmas tree lights, if one bulb went out, then the rest of the bulbs went out. And that's what we call serial processing. And then we developed other ways, which is distributed processing. These newer algorithms consume a lot of power because we cannot distribute them. They're so sophisticated. Every little node needs to talk to each other. And that's generating a lot of demand for data centers, generating a lot of demand for energy. And oddly enough, that's actually a concern that I have for real estate, is basic energy generation. It sounds odd, but it's a concern I have.
And to dive into that, and just for clarifying, do you mean energy generation for the building itself, or?
So energy generation itself, and then the distribution of that energy to all of these buildings. Because if you're building a data center, you assume the lights will always turn on. And that may not be true if we aren't able to increase energy generation or transform it in some way.
Sounds like a pro-nuclear statement, but that might be another call. Going off of one of your last statements around real estate potentially leaping forward and almost complicating the process before actually having the basics down, how have you seen modeling, forecasting, and overall prediction when applied to commercial real estate really change since you started in the industry?
As I say, the data are getting better, and that's an important achievement. That was one of the early achievements of Torto and Wheaton, was just to improve the data. And so I know you folks are very focused on this idea. Improving the data will be a very important advance. And that's what I'm trying to do, again, with the Applied Analytics Lab, just making a university the neutral arbiter in all of this. Then with improved data, we can begin to think about how well these advanced algorithms work. So I have a little pet paper that I love to show to both finance people and to computer scientists that starts out with very simple analytics and a very simple financial model, and then applies, I hold the model fixed, I hold the data fixed, and I just move through the evolution of analytics. And what happens, interestingly enough, is the performance of the algorithms decline as you make them more advanced by usual measures in statistics. And when I show it to finance people, they're like, oh yeah, that makes complete sense. And when I show it to computer scientists, they just say, oh, you didn't tune your model enough. But the point is that I held fixed the data, and I just applied more sophisticated models. We in commercial real estate can't hold the data fixed. We have to do a better job on the data so that we can begin to advance the analytics. And there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in this industry.
Tim, I think that's a decent segue into one of these next questions we have. And you mentioned the PE shops and a lot of the other big asset managers. They've all got huge data science teams now. Where do you think CRE really sits? Are we behind? And if so, how far behind are we? I just wanted to get your thoughts on like kind of where we sit in terms of progress there.
I think on the residential side, we're thinking about real estate big, beyond commercial. On the residential side, we're in a good place, right? The analytics, we have a lot of data. We have some sound analytics. We'll set aside Zillow for a while. And on the residential side, we're in a good position. On the commercial side, though, as I say, we just don't have the type of data that would really take advantage of these advanced algorithms. So that's another form of decoupling, which is the data are too far behind the algorithms.
You seen any use cases or any players that actually have done this very well, whether that is solving the data first and then applying the more advanced techniques, or any that have stuck to the KISS principle, right? Keep it simple, silly, and focused on, all right, well, these are our data limitations. Like, this is about as far as we can push these models. But by not pushing further, we actually are arriving at a better understandable process and outcome. Are there any leaders in this space that or use cases that you could call out?
Yeah, I'm not going to mention any names, but yes, I was pessimistic when I first started at Shack that some of the big PE players would get it right. I think they got it wrong for long enough so that they stepped back and they said, well, where are the problems here? And they began to focus on the data. If you're a large private equity firm, you have access to a lot of data. And you don't need to deploy neural networks to try to make informed decisions about whether you're going to raise rents or build another space. I haven't mentioned it. I advise a prop tech startup in the residential area or the residential space. And my entire focus there has been, don't focus on the algorithms. Focus on getting the data as accurate as you can get it, and then the algorithms will come. And happily, the founder has listened to me on that front, and that's how we're evolving now.
So what I'm hearing is that the industry broadly has the right talent, the fact that we were able to overcomplicate, I would say collectively have the right tools in the sense that the data does exist, albeit potentially in pockets and maybe not entirely as accessible. And I know that's something that the lab's helping to break down or solve for. What are your kind of expectations over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of putting these together, the talent and the tools, and ultimately advancing commercial real estate?
I can talk about my vision for the Applied Analytics Lab, which I think is an answer to your question. I want the Applied Analytics Lab to be a neutral location for commercial real estate data, to be able to say to a large PE firm, I can show you how to de-identify and anonymize your data, but I need to hold the correlation patterns there. Because if we get rid of the correlation patterns, no algorithm is going to function. And what I wanted to be able to say to these PE shops or to other large owner occupiers is, let me train an algorithm on all of the data, and then I'll license the algorithm back to you. And the algorithm is more accurate because it's seen some larger universe of data, and it becomes more valuable to an individual entity like a large private equity firm. And that is an attempt to go back to the old Torta-Wheaton model, which is what they used to do. And it makes a lot of sense given the fragmentation. And then I can give lectures to their data scientists if they want me to come along and do it. But it's trying to find a better universe of data. We know from a statistical point of view that it is far better to observe precisely 20% of the universe than it is imprecisely to see the entire universe. And that's really, I think, my mission now with the Applied Analytics Lab and even with CREFC.
I love that answer. And I think you'll probably understand where I'm going with these next few questions, but you've been in the industry for a long time. I think you said since at least 99. And so 25 years, what do you think has changed the most about CRE research? This is the stuff that Omar and I do every day, but we probably have tools that you didn't even dream of when you got started. So what do you think has changed the most? Is this can be anything? I'm thinking different types of analysis, different types of data, tech. What do you think has been the biggest?
Over my career, again, the basics of real estate, location, 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 brick by brick, block by block, we can't step around that. What we can do is collect more information by brick and block by block and by location. And with that enhanced data set, we can do more. So early in my life, I used to do fair lending models to ensure that lending followed the laws that we have in this country. And I learned a great deal then, because that's when I began to work with banks, who would then say, here is our lending information. And I remember the first time I had my first trillion observation data set. That was a lot of fun. And that's where I think the CRE industry needs to catch up, right? Anytime you buy something in a store, that information is being recorded. So it needs to be more frequent. You can't live on a quarterly basis. It needs to be more accurate, and it needs to be more granular. So granularity, accuracy, and timeliness are things I talk about a lot when I teach data science to students.
Or data quality concepts. And I would say accessibility, I would add that one. I think that's...
Yeah, that's a good one. Yep.
Because you could have great data quality, but if you can't access it, that's a problem. But with this, do you see the role of research really changing in terms of the context of commercial real estate investment or capital allocation decisions?
Again, I'll answer the question as a wish. I wish that research played a more important role. We did achieve some of that at CBRE, where we would issue a forecast. We'd have brokers criticize the forecast. I'd say, I'm happy to come to a meeting. And we brought CBRE research together with the brokerage community to try to close deals. And it was, when it worked so well. And I think that the importance and the role of research, even as a cost function within real estate, is important. Folks should try to do a better job of recording their return on investment to research. I think it's something they underappreciate, especially in the brokerage world. But I think it's foundational, and Torta and Wheaton proved that.
Tim, I think we're coming up on the end of our time here together. And one of the things that you've mentioned really drives you is shaping the next generation of CRE professionals. So I want to ask if you've recommendations for those folks who are early in their career. Maybe you can use this as some time to plug NYU Shack or the CREFC Center, but what would you offer up for those folks?
I think, so I'm going to reflect the view of my friend Jack Cohen, who is one of the CREFC advisors, when he says network, right? Something I never needed to do as an economist, right? It's, here's my dissertation, here's my analysis to get this merger through to monopoly. But Jack when I ask him to guest lecture, which he's always willing to do, emphasizes to students, networking is important. Why Krefsi has a young fellows program or a young professionals program. And one advantage we have at NYU is every student of ours is automatically a Krefsi member. It's part of the gift agreement. And they love the conferences, but I want them to network. I think, again, it sounds strange to come from an economist, but it is very important. This is, as much as I might not like it, this is still a relationship business. And developing early relationships is very important. And Jack Cohen has taught me that.
If they don't want to hear it from an economist, they can hear it from me. I've certainly got a lot out of the Krefsi Young Professionals events. And I always enjoy hearing from Jack as well. But Tim, our last question, we ask this to every guest, and you can answer this however you like, but it's, if you could snap your fingers and have any change come to the industry, what would that be? It could be data related. We've had some funny answers to this. One guest wanted Jay Powell to disappear. You don't have to use that one, but anything that could come to the industry, what would it be?
Move faster. There's no reason why you need to think about a world in which a 10-year lease and monthly payments governs what goes on in this industry.
Great answer. Tim, I thank you very much for joining us today and giving us some great insights about the industry, about data, about research, a lot of things that we talk about on a daily basis. So I really appreciate it. But Omar, I think that is all the time we've got today for CRE Exchange. And I look forward to speaking with you on another episode. Have a good one.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.